Hi, this is Rusty Reno here at the First Things office, and I'm delighted to have Michael Echelon here with me to talk about Lionel Trilling. Michael is the Professor Emeritus of Education from Boston University and Professor of Anglophone Culture at the Italian University in Switzerland.
University of Italian Switzerland,
thanks. He's also the author of The Restitution of Man, a study of C.S. Lewis and his critiques of scientism. Great to have you here, Michael, at the First Things office.
Thank you.
Lionel Trilling, the occasion of our talk is the publication of a selection of his letters that's edited by Adam Kirsch, titled Life in Culture, Selected Letters of Lionel Trilling. But before we get to the letters, I just want to get a sense, Michael, of your connection to Trilling. I mean, he's really one of the most important cultural and literary figures of the post-war era. And you were a student of his at Columbia University. When did you meet him? What was the first encounter with Lionel Trilling?
Well, I had him both when I was an undergraduate between 66 and 70. In my last year as an undergraduate, I took a course for which he was rather famous, although he didn't give it that often toward the end of his life. It was a course on Wordsworth.
Mm.
And then in the last year of his life, which was 1975, I was in his doctoral seminar in the autumn that he died of pancreatic cancer. Mm. I didn't know Trilling well as a person. I knew his work well, and I admired him. And he was a very strong presence at Columbia for 40 years. And I had originally gone to Columbia after going to boarding school in New England, partly because of its reputation as a great books undergraduate curriculum, the John Erskine idea of the moral obligation to be intelligent. And that was the Arnold tradition, the Matthew Arnold tradition. Trilling wrote a great book on Arnold, 1939.
Yeah, that was his dissertation, yep. In effect.
Yep. Yeah, it was.
Wasn't it Leon Wieseltier wrote an appreciation of Trilling?
Yes, he's written.
Using that the obligation or the duty to be intelligent as his
title. Of an essay by John Erskine, who mm-hmm. really brought the great books undergraduate curriculum into existence at Columbia around 1918, 1920. Erskine wrote an essay which was published around 1916 called The Moral Obligation to Be Intelligent. And Wieseltier brought out an anthology of Trilling's writings maybe 10 years ago.
Yes.
With that title.
Right. You know, one of the things that I'm very struck by in the Trilling essays is that I would not call him a literary critic, strictly speaking. I would call him a cultural critic.
I think that's right.
Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's right. And really a moralist.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. You know, and perhaps a little more in the French sense than the sense in which we use it. Trilling was probably responsible for bringing the Cambridge Don Basil Willey to Columbia for a year. And Willey was King Edward VII Professor of English Literature at Cambridge for many years, and he pioneered from the 20s on an undergraduate concentration which still exists at Cambridge called the English Moralists.
Right.
And Trilling's very much in that tradition of the English Moralists, particularly Arnold.
Yeah, I didn't know that they had that connection, because when I was a grad student, when I discovered Basil Willey's wonderful
books.
Yeah. What is it? 19th century studies, more 19th century studies, 18th century background, crushingly boring titles, but just fantastic, marvelous expositional prose and of the great tradition in the English-speaking world.
Absolutely. And Willie was actually a rather serious Christian. He was a Methodist, and he was part of an important kind of dissenting Christian presence at Cambridge, which has always been the more scientific of the two great universities.
Right.
And from the 20s on, his antagonist, unfortunately, because they really had a lot in common, but they were personally antipathetic to each other, was F.R. Leavis.
Right.
And Trilling had quite a lot to do with Leavis, too, particularly through the intervention of Norman Podoritz, who was a student of both of them. First here, Podoritz at Columbia and Jewish Theological Seminary. Then he won a Columbia Kellett Fellowship, and he was at Cambridge for 3 years.
Right.
And became student of Leavis. And then Leavis's writing as a moralist came into the U.S. largely through the commentary circle, and that was Trilling, and that was Podoretz, the commentary circle of American Jews.
You know, I always think of Leavis as a kind of literary Trotskyite. You're either in or you're out, so to speak. Whereas I think of Trilling as much more ecumenical or liberal in the sense that he wrote about not just, you know, the great tradition, but also about the Kinsey Report. I remember reading
essay,
which is a very
perceptive. In the liberal imagination.
Yeah, it's a very perceptive essay about why the Kinsey Report resonated so deeply. And he had forebodings about that, didn't he? The Bohemian.
He disliked it intensely, the Kinsey Report.
But he had misgivings about the Bohemian. He wasn't prudish or and moralistic in that sense, but he felt that the moral order was a crucial source of dignity for the person. It's the framework in which one pursued one's life. Is that fair?
I think that's right. The book that, after Liberal Imagination, 1950, the book in which that's clearest is called Beyond Culture, which
yes.
is a series of essays. And I think the most powerful one in it is the first one, which is an essay about teaching modern literature and about his ambivalence about the ferocity of modern literature. And he makes a famous, it's called On the Teaching of Modern Literature, 1961. And he makes a comment that became very notable and was often quoted. I've quoted it in my own publications over the years. He said nothing was more characteristic of modern life, and particularly not a modern life, of modern literature, than its actually subversive intention. And then its canonization of what he called the primal non-ethical energies.
Mm.
He's got in mind people like Gide, a lot of the French, in fact, Baudelaire, Rimbaud, Les Maudits, but also even D.H. Lawrence.
Oh, yeah, especially D.H. Lawrence. Yeah.
And it's Trilling's wife edited the portable D.H. Lawrence, and she was an advocate of Lawrence. But in Trilling, a lot of the older Arnoldian humanism was powerful. He and Leavis are very close in a lot of things. I gave a lecture on Leavis at Cambridge in 2015, which has subsequently been published in a book of essays on Leavis. And Leavis was more narrowly the moralist. He discerned what he called a great tradition of English letters, and he excommunicated people from it.
Yeah, that's the Trotskyite element.
That's right. Now, there was an element of... I see him as an extraordinarily noble person, Leavis. He was a person with a Christian sensibility, even a puritanical sensibility. Cambridge, right. of the two universities, is the one with the Puritan legacy. Strong in the sciences, particularly on the religious side, more likely to have dissenters than Anglicans, you know, Methodists and dissenters and so forth. That whole section of Eastern England was a hotbed of Puritanism, so Cromwell's from, and Bunyan.
Mm-hmm.
Trilling wrote beautifully about, in the same volume that I referred to before, Beyond Culture, he wrote beautifully about the Snow-Leavis controversy of 59-62, which is essentially a two cultures dispute. And of course, Leavis famously wrote about that in the book called The Two Cultures. I would say those two critics, both of them, Leavis certainly in the shadow of Eliot. Leavis, amazingly enough, a non-Christian, actually married to a Jewish woman, who herself wasn't able to get a job in Cambridge, partly because she was a woman, partly because she was Jewish, and in fact her parents disowned them when she married outside of Jewry. But Trilling, of course, was Jewish. And he and his wife both, she was, Diana Trilling's also.
Yeah, he was the first Jewish tenured faculty member in English at Columbia, and that was a matter of controversy at the time.
That was President Butler, Nicholas Murray Butler, who was a very great man, and he gave Trilling his foot in the door in a summer appointment.
Mm-hmm.
Even though by that, Trilling was already something of a star, and Trilling wrote about that. I mean, there was... As you know, Rusty, I'm sure very well, there was a widespread anti-Semitism just before World War II. And, of course, World War II, with its atrocities, had a lot to do with discrediting it.
Yes.
But Trilling was the first person to get tenure at Columbia. I think there may have been one or two people in the med school, but certainly not in the humanities. He was the first Jewish person to get tenure at Columbia in 1939, and it was Butler who gave him a foot in the door.
Yeah, that was the era, or the end of the era, of the great imperial presidencies, college presidencies, and he was certainly one of the towering figures of American higher education. One of the things that I look back on, I read very extensively Trilling as a young professor, and it made a big impact on me. One of the things about his essays is they're very hard to imitate in writing. They sort of go sideways, and they gather in, and it's that amazing ability to knit together close reading. I mean, you really are engaging the literary figure that he has got before you, that he weaves in cultural commentary. And it's effortless, but you try to unzip it, and it's very difficult to do so. It really is very, they're beautifully crafted essays, I think exemplary of how to combine literature and cultural analysis.
I think that's
kind of dropped by the wayside, hasn't it?
In some ways, the Wieseltier anthology helped to bring him into light. I think William Barrett's idea in that wonderful book, The Truants, from the early 80s, William Barrett wrote a memoir about the New York intellectuals. I'm trying to bring it back into print at this very moment, as a matter of fact, with a new introduction by me. I'm not getting very far yet. He has a chapter in there called Lionel Trilling and the Beginning of Neoconservative Thought. He sees Trilling as the godfather of the neoconservatives.
Yeah, that's plausible to me.
And I think that's true.
Because he's concerned about moral order, manners, form, that without form, these primal energies, so to speak, they become dissipating and destructive.
And Dionysiac, absolutely. No, I thought you were good yourself, Rusty, in your remarks about that up at Yale, about people wanting to live their lives without the arche, without the guidance of fixed transcendental ideas of the true, the good, the beautiful, ethical obligation, and so forth. And Trilling, I would say Trilling was the godfather of the neoconservatives. And I would say now on the landscape, the person who is really most his successor, although she herself is now very old, is Gertrude Himmelfarb. She and Irving Kristol were friends of his. And she has really pioneered, and through her, Bill Kristol, in his way, has pioneered a kind of cultural criticism that we can see in Arnold, and of which both Trilling and Leavis are wonderful exponents. And you're right in that Trilling writes cultural criticism. He's interested in Arnold's idea of seeing life steadily and seeing it whole. And he thinks all human beings, and especially intellectuals, have an obligation beyond professional specialization to have a moral stance toward reality. And to have one that is available for articulation in the broader culture.
Yeah, a person who's really helped me understand Trilling, although doesn't write about him directly, was John Lucas and his notion of the bourgeois era.
Lukács.
Yeah. And the bourgeois era is, it's after theology no longer provides the, if you will, the sacred canopy. And so instead we have to, every generation, renegotiate the nomos, but it is a normative, it's a obligation-driven vision of human flourishing. And I thought Trilling and Barzun in their way, both colleagues that famously taught together many at the seminar, I guess, and at Columbia, were very committed to an engagement with literature as a way that we, every generation, rethinks or renegotiates, if you will, its moral obligations.
I think that's very good.
It's like a Talmud. That's to the Torah. You have the literary Torah, but it needs a Talmud of constant re-engagement and renegotiation and reapplication.
I think that's good. I think that what you have there is what I'm calling the Arnoldian legacy, which is hospitable to Orthodox religion, but sees it failing in the light of modern naturalism, particularly Darwin.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the desire to retain, you might say it's a roots fruits argument, the desire to retain the fruits of a Judeo-Christian civilization without the roots in actual religious practice.
Right.
And that was, I think, Levis too. Levis was notoriously moral in this sense, and most people would say moralistic and use that in a pejorative way. It's not so pejorative for me because I admire him. But I think you're right. This renegotiation of the nomos is an important feature of Trilling's life. He came to eminence, as you probably recall, in the 30s and 40s because he was a man of the left who hated communism.
Right.
And he hated fellow travelers. And he wrote against fellow travelers. He wrote very well against them. And of course, he was notoriously taken up with and concerned with Whitaker Chambers.
Yeah, I mean, I've read a number of years ago, I read his novel, The Middle of the Journey, which is a polemic against fellow travelers, even more than a polemic against communists.
Absolutely. And it's dominated by the figure of Gifford Maxim, who is the Chambers figure.
Mm-hmm.
And when Trilling talked about his writing of it, he had a very different novel in mind than what he produced, because he said his memory of Chambers and Chambers's going into communism and then being for a while an operative of the OGPU and the NKVD in the United States, and then Chambers leaving communism and being a hard-edged anti-communist. Trilling said Chambers took over the novel, and that Chambers became the great figure in the figure of Gifford Maxim.
Right.
Who is disapproved by the decent liberal John Laskell, but also admired for the single-mindedness of his conviction. Dostoevskian figure, like
right.
Kirillov or Stavrogin or something. And it's a wonderful novel. It's wonderful. It's never really gotten its due. Trilling didn't understand why Viking didn't bring it out again when the Chambers case broke.
Mm-hmm.
Around 1949-50, because the novel came out in 48 and it got good reviews. It was not brought out again. And he kept writing to his editor, Kovicki, at Viking about why it wasn't brought up, because it was so perfect for Alger and Priscilla Hiss are very much like the Krooms in the novel.
Yes.
And Gifford Maxim is clearly modeled on Chambers. And Laskell is the decent liberal intellectual, is sympathetic to Marxist perspectives, but not a communist. And we now know that the reason it didn't get brought out, and in fact the next edition that came out was in Britain, where it was better received. The reason it didn't get brought out around 1950 was that the head of Viking, Ben Hubsch, was a communist.
Right. Right, right,
and hated the book.
But if you read the novel, it back to your point about the primal energies, it is a Jane Austen-esque in style and not D.H. Lawrence. It's not. It doesn't have the, because a lot of 1950s successful novels had this kind of a primal energy in them, and so you can see that he wrote effectively what. His literary style is in accord with his own sense of what's fitting for a humane culture.
Yes, I think he felt a great deal of loyalty to this Erskine ideal of the moral obligation to be intelligent, which really was the momentum and trajectory of the Arnoldian tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Try to see life steadily and see it whole. That every intellectual has an obligation to the social and political order. To maintain and retain the beauty and dignity of the rational life. And that was an effect of Trilling's own personal appearance and behavior. He was a shy man. He was a courtly man.
Hmm.
He dressed rather elegantly, but he was rather shy. And he had a wonderful, this comes across very well in the letters, he had a wonderful courtesy with people. A lot of these letters, he was answering apparently for the last 25 years of his life over 600 letters a year. He was
mm-hmm.
answering over 600 letters a year.
Right.
And from all sorts of conditions of people. This volume that we're looking at here, edited by Kirsch, only has about 200 letters. But he took the trouble to treat his students and to treat his, I've spoken with him a number of times. I spoke with him a number of times as his student. And he was very courteous. By contrast, as you probably recall, because you went to Yale and you probably had some real hotshots up there too, a lot of star intellectuals who have left-wing views are notoriously snobbish and difficult to deal with. I had Edward Said as a teacher. He's a terribly snobbish man. He was notorious for, you'd have to wait the longest time to get an interview, an appointment with him in his office, and then you'd come into his office, he wouldn't ask you just to be seated. This is your doctoral students. He doesn't ask you to take a seat. Right. You know? And here's a man of the most correct left-wing sentiments, an egalitarian. He's got beautiful oriental carpets. He's got his own secretary. You come in and he has an interview with you where he doesn't ask you to take a seat. I mean, just ridiculous. You know? But Trilling was a man of great courtesy. And there was a real integrity to him, you know. Blessed is the man, his life is whole, via integra est. Mm-hmm. He had that. There was a charm, but there was a shyness to it. And his moral authority came through the writing. He was a good lecturer, but not spectacular. A good lecturer and a judicious mind. You saw a judicious mind at work.
Hmm. What if somebody wants to read a Trilling essay? Do you have one or two favorites?
Well, I think the one on the Leavis Snow controversy, which is in Beyond Culture, I think that's really a terrific essay, and that in a culture such as ours that is now so much dominated by STEM, mm-hmm. science, technology, engineering, and math, and so forth, that's very good, because what it does is to update the Arnold Huxley debates of the 1870s and 80s, which is my book's about, my first book, which is coming out again in French. And it's a wonderful updating of that and an exhibition of how continuously relevant it is that humanistic education, about which you and I were just talking up at Yale, I didn't get to talk very long, but humanistic education in the modern world is always embattled and endangered. Often in the hands of people who don't really believe in it in any recognizably Aristotelian sense or Arnoldian sense, certainly not in a Christian sense, and no longer in a Judeo-Christian sense either. Humanistic education is in the hands of people who have agendas that are basically neo-Marxist. And I think in a way you could see people such as Trilling and Leavis as essentially in reaction to the Nietzschean threat to a culture.
Right, because the neo-Marxism is metaphysically materialist at the end of the day. You know, we are our desires or our, you know, will to power and so on. What do you make of the fact that it seems to me that the Trilling Leavis project has been very much eclipsed, and that young people, or forget young people, people under 50 don't look to literature for moral and cultural orientation anymore?
I think there's a lot to that. I think part of it is that the extraordinary development of audiovisual culture, with an amazing potency of appeal to younger people, makes the slower pace of the novel or the reflective essay a hard sell. Now, Dickens's novels, I edited a new edition of A Tale of Two Cities back in 2012, and I teach Dickens. Dickens's 13 novels have never been out of print. But even Dickens is a hard read because the novels are so long.
They are. It's part of the pleasure of them.
Yeah. Now, this is not a universal thing, because I'm told by colleagues, and I've had some experience of this because I teach in Switzerland, and I've had some wonderful Russian students. The Russians still read. Mm-hmm. They read Dostoevsky, they read Tolstoy, they read Pasternak, they read Solzhenitsyn. The Russians still read, but I think in our country, I would say it has a lot to do with Charles William Eliot at Harvard bringing in a wholly elective curriculum from 1870s on.
Right.
Harvard goes the nation educationally in some ways. Thank God it didn't happen here totally, because you have Columbia and Chicago, which still have really serious undergraduate programs, probably the best in the country in terms of undergraduate requirements and so forth. Although often taught by people who wish to subvert them, you know. But the Harvard idea, the idea of radical electives, that the 18-year-old knows what he ought to take, no subsequent dean at Harvard, even though many of them have expressed distress about this this development over the last 150 years. No dean has had the power to walk that back into a required undergraduate mm-hmm. curriculum. They just don't have the power. Because the department chairs at a place like Harvard are incredibly powerful, and they're all shopping their disciplines to make specialists. So Columbia and Chicago in that way are the last stand of the, and the small Catholic colleges. Some of the small evangelical colleges, great books of Notre Dame has a program of liberal studies. Those are the places where there's still some sense of history and literature and philosophy as the core of a really educated person's curriculum vitae. And in our culture, the velocity and the potency of the visual image, of audiovisual culture, makes it very hard to elicit that kind of reflective, slower pace. Mm-hmm. Even conversation like yours and mine right now, it's a hard conversation. People's attention span attention spans are more limited.
Yeah, we had a great piece by Patricia Snow about the effect of the small screen, the smartphone, spiritual as well as intellectual.
And your man Bauerlein's written well about
yes,
this.
Yes, Mark.
In that book
the
I reviewed.
Generation.
In that he submitted an essay to that book I reviewed for National Review.
Yes, Closing of the American Mind.
That's very good. Yeah. I think that's very, very good. And it's there was an element of panic in that essay. It was an apocalyptic essay about what's happening.
No, Mark, apocalyptic? Come on.
I share some of that sense because I myself, have been teaching for 50 years and mostly university teaching and with considerable degree of success, but it has partly to do with pace and rate of reflection.
Mm-hmm.
Given the velocity of the audiovisual culture and the potency of the imagery, it's hard to get people to reflect in the way that Trilling writes for a different kind of reader.
They are patient essays as he unfolds his theme. As I say, they're very carefully woven together, and he unfolds his theme, kind of circles back and unfolds at a different level. That's a great point. Somebody who wants to know, well, what's the thesis? Give me the executive summary. His essays don't lend themselves to that kind of boiling down to a single point.
If you look at his introduction to Dickens's Little Dorrit, which is one of the best things I've ever read on Dickens, and I had to read a lot of the criticism in connection with my new edition of Tale of Two Cities back in 2012, that is a magnificent essay. And one of the most touching things about it is that he sees it as fundamentally the most profoundly Christian of all of Dickens' novels. Now, Trilling is essentially a naturalist.
Yes.
Essentially conditioned by Freud, first by Marx, then Freud, and at Columbia you couldn't escape the influence of John Dewey, who lived mm-hmm. almost 100 years, and the last 40 of them at Columbia, died in 1952. And the presiding presence of that kind of philosophical naturalism you found in a historian of science such as Nagel, Ernest Nagel, and then Dewey, and then so many people in philosophy at Columbia. Trilling couldn't escape that. And his own loyalties largely to a conservative view of Freud, the Freud of civilization and its discontent.
Yeah, it's the Philip Reeve meeting of Freud Freud as a moralist.
As a moralist. Yeah.
Trying to have a kind of humane moral frame.
And very pessimistic in 1939 when Civilization and Discontent came out. Very pessimistic about the willingness of people actually to accept inhibition, renunciation of desire, restraint, sublimation, repression. At the end of Freud's life, he's for all these things.
Yes, he is. Yeah, I think his reception in America tended to be one
liberationist
reading.
You may have seen my attack on him recently, the longish piece I did for Modern Age on mm-hmm. Freud, because I reviewed Fred Cruz's terrific attack on Freud's alleged scientific status. And Cruz has been at this for 15, 20 years now, and I think he's right. Freud's not a scientist. Freud's a polemical writer with an agenda, essentially a Nietzschean agenda. But at the end of his life, he's worried. He's probably worried about the kind of liberation that he himself stimulated.
Exactly. I didn't want things to go too far.
Yeah.
Well, Trilling Trolling's certainly a great figure and was, like as I said, an important part of my own formation, not just as a thinking, but in terms of how to write for a broader public audience. So I really am grateful for your time to come in and talk to us about Trilling and your memories of him as a teacher and his contribution to the Republic of Letters. Thanks, Michael.
I think it was. Thank you.